I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. If you are even a casual sports fan, then you already know about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He is celebrated around the world as one of the greatest basketball players ever. The UCLA grad spent some 20 years in the pros, playing for the Milwaukee Bucks and later the Los Angeles Lakers. He was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame soon after his 1989 retirement, and to this day remains the NBA's all-time leading scorer. You might also know that post-retirement, he has pursued his interest in education and history, penned several bestsellers, and produced two documentaries. But what you might not know is that he has added another title to his long resume: ambassador. Last month, he was named a U.S. cultural ambassador by the U.S. State Department. In that role, he traveled to Brazil. He is now back and here to tell us more about it and whatever else is on his mind. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. And do I have to call you Excellency?
No, you don't. Just call me Kareem. That'll be fine.
Tell me why you were interested in this role. It's actually a rather demanding one. People might not know this, but it involves quite a lot of travel and some very, you know, intense scheduling.
I remember that Louis Armstrong did the same thing for President Kennedy during his administration. And, you know, Louis Armstrong was a hero of mine. Following in his footsteps really is very meaningful for me.
What do kids, I know that you're spending a lot of emphasis on education in this role. How do the kids that you talk to, do they want to talk about this or do they want to talk about basketball?
They're interested in what I had to say because the Brazilian government is making it's an affirmative action kind of attempt for the whole country because Brazilians of African descent were neglected and not really given access to the mainstream Brazilian society. And they're making a concerted effort to change that now. And they want the people in these disadvantaged areas to embrace education so that they can take the jobs that Brazil needs to fill in order to make their attempt to move up several levels and become a first-tier nation. They just found a lot of oil off the shore of Rio de Janeiro, and they expect that there's a lot more there. So, you know, they'll be able to bankroll this without much problem. So they've made a concerted effort to reduce crime and make educational opportunities available to all of Brazilian society. And the United States is working hand in hand with them. And part of the program will be teaching English because English is the international language of business. People in Brazil have a great deal of regard for President Obama, because in seeing someone of African descent become president of our nation, that means a lot to them. You know, they share a lot of history with us in that, you know, the history of slavery and denial of rights and access for people of African descent. And to see that change to the point where a person of African descent can become president really impressed them and gave them a very positive idea of what potentially democracy can mean for their nation.
It's interesting. I asked you about yourself, and you've talked about the president, and I understand that, but do you find it difficult after all these years in the limelight to talk about yourself?
No. The reason that they sent me was because I kind of represent that whole dynamic. My parents didn't have any money or anything. You know, I came from very poor circumstances, and I was able to do very well by taking advantage of educational opportunities and the game of basketball.
But do kids think that the reason you are successful is your education? Because as we mentioned, you are a college graduate and also have, as we've said, a very avid interest in history. But do kids see that? I mean, do they make the connection between your education and your success, or do they mainly think it's about sports?
That's hard to say, but I would say from the reaction, there were a lot of parents there when I was talking to the various groups of kids. They saw that that message was very meaningful for their children, and they wanted them to get a grasp on exactly what that meant. That, coupled with the efforts of the Brazilian government to get as many people involved in reaching and striving for higher educational positions, really has given the message a chance to get through to the kids.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with basketball legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He is a Hall of Famer, and he has now been named a U.S. cultural ambassador. He's recently returned from his first trip as a U.S. cultural ambassador to Brazil. Where else do you think you might go?
There's been mention that I'll be going to South Africa on my next assignment, but I really don't know. You know, I take my assignments as they come.
You mentioned that you have an avid interest in history, and to that end, I want to talk about one of your other new ventures, your new children's book. But before we do, I wanted to ask where your interest in history comes from. Have you always been interested?
I've always been interested in it. A lot of it had to do with where I was raised in Manhattan, in Washington Heights. It was a Revolutionary War battlefield. I was always aware of the fact that there were a lot of people that were around before us, and the things that they attempted to do affect our lives.
Your new children's book is titled What Color Is My World? The Lost History of African American Inventors. You wrote this. Your co-author is Raymond Obstfeld. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I did a book. It was an overview of African American history. It's called Black Profiles in Courage. And I did a whole chapter on Lewis Latimer, who discovered the filament for the light bulb that made it a practical item that everyday people could use. And in reading about his life, I discovered a lot of things about African-American inventors of the 19th century.
Which one is your favorite?
Lewis Latimer. You know, he was involved in things that are so crucial nowadays. He did Alexander Graham Bell's patent application drawings for the telephone. And then he worked for Mr. Edison. He was the key for Mr. Edison's success. And people didn't know anything about him.
There's one person in there I'm not sure I think. George Crumb.
George Crumb invented the potato chip.
I'm not sure I'm happy about that. I guess if he didn't, somebody else would. But
it's
been a continuing bane of my existence, yes. So.
But they're delicious. And, you know, you just have to do a little bit more exercise.
Okay.
They won't hurt you.
Well, thank you. There's only one woman in this book. What's up with that? Valerie Thomas.
Dr. Valerie Thomas, who her take on how to do 3D is really the template for 3D processing at this time. She was the only one I could find that had done something significant.
So you're trying to find people whose accomplishments are not as well known, but who still, whose contributions are things that we use and touch and can relate to. And that's the only woman you could find. That's a shame.
Yeah, it was. Certain things that were done by African-Americans have been crucial. And for example, Dr. Charles Drew, just his ability to figure out blood typing and starting the blood bank, that has saved millions of lives and will continue to on into the future.
Sports, obviously, is one bridge to connecting with people, to get them to listen to what you have to say. I'm wondering if religion is another at a time when there's some tension between, I don't know how you feel about the term, the Muslim world, and everybody doesn't love that term, but as one of the first prominent African-Americans to convert to Islam, do you feel that you also have perhaps an ability to connect with people in that way that someone else might not?
I'm hoping that people will see that I'm a loyal, patriotic American citizen. It was such a long time that American Muslims were really under the radar. I think they got used to that. And then after 9/11, that changed radically, and we've had to go several additional steps to show people that crazy radical people who believe in violence pop up in every ideology and every culture. Unfortunately, it's a part of the human condition.
Has 9/11 changed your life?
In little ways. You know, I came back from a vacation in Mexico, and some radical person from Afghanistan or Pakistan has the same name as I do, and I had to go and I got separated out of the line, and I had to explain who I was. It was
really? As prominent as you are?
They realized who I was, but, you know, they had to, like, deal with the issue because I share the same name with this other person. But they got it done. They said, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, born in 1947, 7 feet 2 inches tall, 250 pounds. You know, they put my description there, and the fact that I am definitely a loyal American citizen.
You know, before we let you go, I did want to focus on a chapter of your personal story that some people might not have heard, but this has been recounted in a new memoir by the former chief rabbi of Israel. Rabbi Israel Meir Lau was the chief rabbi of Israel at the time and survived the concentration camp Buchenwald, the death camp, as a child. And one of your father's close friends was an American soldier who helped free the camp in the mid-1940s. And at that time, your father couldn't travel because of health reasons. And when he heard you were going to Israel, he asked you to meet with Rabbi He recounts this very movingly in his new memoir, and I just wanted to know if you remembered that moment.
I think that story has gotten distorted because I was interviewed by an Israeli journalist, and there was a language problem. Hmm. One of my father's good friends was in the 761st Tank Battalion, and they liberated Dachau.
Okay.
Rabbi Lau was at Buchenwald. Buchenwald was liberated by black troops in the 183rd Combat Engineers. But my father's friend had nothing to do with that.
Hmm. You've had a very interesting life. What would you like people to learn from you who perhaps don't have the opportunity to see you in person on your journeys as a representative of the government and
I guess,
of the United States?
This is a statement I'm stealing from somebody, but it's been said that life is short, but it's really wide. You know, get into all of it that you can. It's a broad and wonderful experience.
Do you have any wisdom to pass on?
Just knowledge is power. Accumulate as much of it as you can and go where your instincts tell you to go.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is the legendary basketball player. He is the author of several best-selling books. His latest is a children's book. It's called What Color Is My World? The Lost History of African-American Inventors. And he is a U.S. cultural ambassador. He was named so by the State Department last month. And he was kind enough to join us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Ambassador, Excellency, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, thank you so much for speaking to us.
My pleasure. Nice visiting with you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. President Obama's new budget is the talk of Capitol Hill this week, and while most of the headlines are about the ongoing fight over how best to reduce the federal deficit, the president's proposal also calls for a significant boost in education funding. It's yet another window into his administration's philosophy around education, and that's what we want to focus on in the first part of the program today. We want to talk about the administration's plan being rolled out today to restructure the way teachers are trained, evaluated, and rewarded across the country. The budget proposal also includes $8 billion to help community colleges train potential workers. We've called NPR's education correspondent Claudio Sanchez to tell us more about that. And we're also going to head to Kentucky, where, as in many states, schools have struggled to meet the requirements of the previous administration's signature education policy, No Child Left Behind. The Obama administration has promised to mend, not end, that policy, and we'll hear how that's working out in one school in Kentucky. But first, to Claudio Sanchez. Claudio, we mentioned some major education elements in the president's budget proposal. Is there anything new here? Is there anything that signals a change in what the administration is trying to do?
Well, as the cliche goes, follow the money. And the money is saying that there will be changes, and there are significant changes ahead. I should say that the Department of Ed is only one of two federal agencies that is getting any kind of boost in its funding. It's not a huge boost, but it's significant in the sense that how it's being targeted. For example, there are three new education initiatives that are unprecedented in funding and scope. Number one, $8 billion to fund and to train 2 million workers in healthcare, transportation, information technology, advanced manufacturing. And a lot of that money is being targeted to community colleges because community colleges, certainly the administration's view, is the one institution that can partner with businesses to identify what skill levels and what new careers can be forged in the future, certainly to guarantee that Americans have jobs.
And what about, there's a new proposal, it's in the style of Race to the Top, which allows states to, or requires them really, to compete for certain pots of money. This is an initiative that will let states compete for a share of $5 billion to train teachers. Is that new? And what's behind this idea?
That is new. It essentially would help states keep good teachers, reward the best ones, overhaul teacher training and development. The goal, the administration says, is to, quote, elevate teachers and change society's view of teaching by making the profession more appealing with higher pay. This is a tricky one because, you know, states are cutting education left and right, and $8 billion sounds like a lot of money. But even if you make it a competitive grants program, states would have to turn on a dime to do a lot of these things. And remember that there's an ongoing debate at the state level about how you identify good teachers. I mean, the unions are still not agreeing with many of the proposals out there, namely those that say, look, merit pay is the way to go. Here's how you evaluate teachers. Do you include test scores of kids to evaluate teachers? The administration years ago, I think, really angered the unions when it came out in favor of what unions considered to be very draconian efforts to redefine the evaluation of teachers and the process. And it has since been struggling to reconcile reconcile that? I see this effort as very much an election year effort on the part of the administration to reconcile this, because it's going to need teachers in supporting the president.
We're talking education and some of the president's priorities in that field. I've been speaking with NPR's education correspondent, Claudio Sanchez. Now I'd like to get an educator's perspective on some of these issues. So we've called upon Tim Roy. He is principal of Webster County High School in Kentucky. We wanted to talk to him in part because last week the Obama administration granted waivers to 10 states, including Kentucky, freeing them from some of the strict standards of the No Child Left Behind Act, which was, of course, the signature education policy of the Bush administration. It's been controversial since its inception, and Principal Roy is with us now. Principal Roy, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, can I just get your kind of overall assessment of how No Child Left Behind has been working in your state? I mean, obviously the intention was, exactly as the program implies, to not allow kids who are not meeting important standards to kind of hide behind the kids who are. But educators have been criticizing it, and parents saying that it really encourages a teach-to-the-test mentality. What's your sense of how it's worked in your state, and how is it viewed?
Well, I think, Michelle, that NCLB is well-intentioned. However, I think that the system that's currently in place is quite restrictive. As you're probably well aware, there are goals that each school must meet and each school district must meet, particularly in the areas of reading and math. And it's our responsibility to report whether we're meeting annual yearly progress in those areas. And the way the system is set up, those goals are determined for us based on past testing data. And it's restrictive in a sense that if we don't meet our annual goal, it's nearly impossible to get out from underneath that, because not only do you have to make up ground from where you score to where your goal was for the previous year, but then you have a higher goal for the next year. So it's one of those systems where if you fall behind, it's almost impossible to get out.
Why did your state apply for the waiver, and what do you hope that it will help you to do that you cannot do now?
Well, first of all, I think one of the key reasons for not just Kentucky, but for several states to seek a waiver is that if we're granted the waiver, we no longer are held to the standard of having all students proficient by 2014. Again, while that's a worthy goal, it's a bit unrealistic under the current system. And, you know, while we can agree that all students can learn and can achieve, not all can learn and achieve at the same rate and given the same deadline. And so by being given this waiver, we're kind of out from under that 2014 deadline.
Claudio, can I ask you if educators across the country with whom you've been speaking agree with Principal Roy's assessment? I do think it's also worth mentioning that Republicans and Democrats in the Congress, who don't seem to agree on a whole lot about a lot of things these days, do seem to agree on that.
Well, Congress agrees to a point, but remember, they're still angry, Republicans in particular, with the president because he's doing this unilaterally. And of course, many say the president had to because Congress was sitting on the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind, and who knows when that's going to be reauthorized. I should say, though, that groups both on the right and the left aren't thrilled about this waiver business because conservatives say the waivers themselves still come with too many strings attached. Liberals, especially in the civil rights community, are afraid that the states will use these waivers to mask what some view as the feeble attempt of states to raise the performance of Latino, Black, poor kids, special education students. Now, the administration, I should say, insists that it's not going to give states so much flexibility that they won't be held accountable. States that get waivers still must adopt rigorous standards, fix dysfunctional schools, close the achievement gap, and just do a better job training and evaluating teachers, which, by the way, is as we had said before, it's no easy task.
Well, Principal Roy, can I ask you, though, about that? Because Kentucky does have students who fit all the categories that Claudio described. How does your state plan to hold itself accountable?
Sure. Well, going back to NCLB, I think we need to clarify a couple things. First of all, in addition to that unrealistic goal of having all students at proficiency by 2014, a couple of other limitations of that legislation is that there is essentially no accountability whatsoever for students that were built into that system. Judgment was rendered exclusively on schools and districts as a part of that testing system, and there was nothing that would hold students accountable. There was no connection to their performance in the classroom, to their grades that they would receive in the classroom. Essentially, we were at the mercy of the students in that situation. And so, with the new new testing system that Kentucky has put in place, students are held accountable for their performance on the test.
Tell me what that means.
Well, again, in the past, we were given a rating of how we performed as a school, but now, particularly at the high school level, we have what's called end-of-course assessments, and we have those in four of our core classes, English 2, Algebra 2, Biology, and U.S. History. And when students take those exams at the end of the year or at the end of the term that they're taking the class, there is a percentage that was recommended by the state of Kentucky that the EOC would count as 20% of the student's overall grade in that class. Districts were given a little leverage to negotiate that percentage, so students are held accountable under this testing system, and I think there will be a little bit more buy-in on the part of students knowing that this could adversely or very positively affect their overall grade in a course.
And finally, before we let you go, Principal Warren, I do appreciate your taking the time. I'm not asking you to render a judgment on sort of the politics of these education proposals sort of federally, but just in terms of the kinds of priorities that are set out, focusing on teacher training, community colleges, offering more flexibility on the standards, are those the kinds of things that educators working in the field as you are think are important, or do you think that there are other priorities that still aren't getting talked about?
I think those are important. I think an increased focus on teacher preparation and what it takes to be an effective educator in today's educational climate and economic climate as well, I think those are very important. And I think that our teachers need to be trained in a way that is going to help them to be successful in leading their students as we move forward. The face of education is continually under construction, and the needs of our students and the needs of our communities are changing. And I think that we need to make sure that our educators are keeping up with that change.
Claudio Sanchez, final thought from you. We've talked about the fact that there seems to be broad agreement on No Child Left Behind in need of an update, but on sort of the broader trend of an educational policy, is this one area in which people from different political perspectives agree on the substance of what the direction the country needs to go in or not?
We don't know exactly where this is headed, but the president is doing something really important. I think he's redefining the federal role in education in subtle ways and charting a new path. And what is it going to take to raise the quality of education, to raise the performance of children at a time when we most need it? Remember, Michelle, that one of the more worrisome things these days is that there are 3 million more children in poverty since the beginning of the recession. And the academic gap between poor and well-to-do students grew 40% from 1960 to 2007. So talk about a challenge of educating children that these days are really struggling, their families are struggling. And, you know, some would say maybe this is a little too late.
Claudio Sanchez is NPR's education correspondent. He was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. We also heard from Tim Roy. He is the principal at Webster County High School in Dixon, Kentucky. That's about 2.5 hours west of Louisville. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Every 10 years, about 24 of the country's top astronomers and astrophysicists get together and make a wish list. On it are the new telescopes they'd most like to see built. At the most recent gathering, here's what topped the list: the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. And for the many of us who don't know what that is, NPR's Joe Palca explains.
I'll assume you know large and telescope, so let's focus on the other two words in the name. For astronomers, a synoptic survey is a comprehensive map of every square inch of the night sky.
We want to scan the entire sky over and over again for 10 years, and we will get over 800 images of every single patch of the sky.
Sidney Wolfe is in charge of building the new telescope. And why take 800 pictures of the sky over 10 years? Well, it's like taking a time-lapse picture of the sky. Anything that moves or changes will be easy to spot.
So one of the things we can do is that if there are any potentially hazardous asteroids out there that might impact the Earth and do significant damage, we will find them.
Wolf says the new telescope will also easily pick up the flash of light from stars that explode overnight and become supernovas. It can also study things that are invisible. Seriously. Here's how that works. There's stuff between us and distant objects called dark matter. As the name suggests, dark matter doesn't give off light. Astronomers are pretty sure it's there, they just don't know what it's made of. To study dark matter, Wolf says the new telescope can look for changes in the shape of distant objects, changes caused by the invisible stuff.
It doesn't matter whether that matter emits light or not, because we're measuring its gravitational effect. And dark matter produces a gravitational effect.
The telescope will ultimately be built on a mountain in Chile. At the heart of the telescope are three large mirrors that will capture starlight. Two of the mirrors are being built at a facility on the University of Arizona campus in Tucson.
From this far away, see the two surfaces? That's our tertiary mirror.
William Gressler is a senior optical engineer for the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, or LSST as it's known. We're standing on a balcony overlooking a cavernous hall located under the university football stadium. Gressler is pointing to what looks like a giant round birthday cake at the other end of the hall. The cake is actually a single piece of glass 27 feet across. You can see what it looks like at npr.org. Gressler says making mirrors for a survey telescope poses some special problems. Once the glass is mounted in the telescope frame, it will need to be swiveled fairly rapidly across the sky.
Part of this survey is we can't take forever moving to the next part of the sky. So we actually move very quickly. Within 5 seconds, we can move from one piece of sky 3.5 degrees over and get ready for another exposure.
Gressler says they've achieved that agility with some innovative mounting hardware that will take the stress off the mirror as it moves. Martha Haynes of Cornell University co-chaired the committee of astronomers that made the LSST top choice for the next big telescope. She says it beat the competition because nearly every astronomer needs a detailed map of the entire sky.
The surveys that are being proposed for the LSST will provide the data sets that a vast variety of astronomers will use to answer fundamentally different questions about the universe.
Right now, all that's holding up the LSST is money. The mirrors were built with private donations. Federal science agencies have pledged support, but money isn't expected to start flowing until the 2014 fiscal year. Joe Palca, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Greece has pushed itself to the edge of chaos with austerity measures, and now European officials are saying that's still not enough. The Greeks need more European help, $170 billion, to avoid default next month. Finance ministers from countries that use the euro held a long conference call yesterday. They concluded that Greece has made progress, but they want much greater oversight over Greece's economy. NPR's Philip Rees is covering this story from Athens. Hi, Philip.
Hi.
How are the Greeks taking the news that they still can't have the money?
Well, there's frustration, there's indignation. There's a feeling among some that the European finance ministers keep moving the goalposts. The Greek parliament endorsed another package of tough austerity measures on Sunday, and that led to riots that damaged and destroyed dozens of buildings in Athens. And since then, the leaders of the two main Greek political parties have signed letters committing to the package, one of the key things that the Eurozone leaders were demanding. And the Greek government and the Eurozone ministers have found more than $300 billion more to slice out of the budget. But there's a huge trust deficit here, Steve, which is why the Eurozone finance ministers now want a better way of tracking Greek spending.
They had demanded those letters from party leaders so that no matter who wins the next election, somebody would be committed to the austerity measures. Now, this raises a question, though, Philip. Is it possible that the Europeans, as they get a closer and closer look at this, have decided they really don't care if Greece collapses or not?
Well, there are signs that some of the northern Europeans are beginning to feel just that, that Europe can now weather a Greek default without suffering too much damage. They're fed up with throwing money at Greece, and they want Greece out of the euro. But opinions are divided about this. Some observers think this is a rather dangerous game of bluff to pressure the Greeks to get serious and provide really concrete guarantees and measures in return for the bailout. They say that a default would, in fact, have a disastrous knock-on effect in Europe. But this issue has certainly stoked up tensions between the Greeks and the rest of the Europeans.
So when you say tensions, what does that look like and feel like in Athens and elsewhere?
Well, there's been a fair amount of ill-tempered verbal skirmishing coming out of Athens. Greece's finance minister has said that some European powers are now playing with fire. He says that those Eurozone nations don't want Greece in the Eurozone anymore, which is why they keep coming up with new terms and conditions. And the Greek president's got even further by denouncing the Germans, the Dutch and the Finns and complaining that Greece is being taunted by Berlin. Those last remarks were in response to the German finance minister, who said that Europe doesn't want Greece to become a bottomless pit for bailout funds. So you can see, Steve, that tempers are certainly fraying. And there are also rumours that Greece won't get its bailout unless there's a senior presence in Athens from the Troika, that's the EU, IMF and ECB, who provide the bailout money. Now, that could be a big issue, of course, because it means a further loss of Greek sovereignty.
So what happens now?
Well, you know, the twists and turns of this Eurozone crisis are pretty impossible to predict. There have been so many endless delays, broken deadlines, squabbles and squalls. But the Eurogroup, that's the Eurozone finance ministers, are now saying that they'll decide whether Greece has actually met the terms of the bailout on Monday.
Well, Philip, as you move around this city where buildings were burned just days ago in the protests against the austerity measures that were passed, what kinds of things are people saying and what does it look like?
Well, you know, it's fascinating because people here really are very emotionally engaged in this crisis. You see people having arguments on street corners. There's a great deal of anger. And there's a sense that history is a sort of seamless tapestry. History is present. You hear people talking about the Second World War. You hear them talking about Churchill. They even go back to the ancient Greeks. So this is an issue that's giving rise to strong emotions, which, of course, is to be expected in a place where there have been so many job losses, so many people have seen their incomes cut, and there's been such a severe recession.
Philip, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Philip Reeves in Athens reporting on Greece's debt crisis.
We know people have a very high expectation of Apple. We have an even higher expectation of ourselves. Those words yesterday from Tim Cook, Apple's new chief executive. He was speaking at an investors conference, and that word expectation is a clear reference to what's been an ugly new year for Apple. Last month, the New York Times reported on worker abuses at the facilities of Foxconn, Apple's largest parts supplier based in China. And that has led to widespread criticism of Apple and protests at some of its stores. To begin to repair its image, the tech giant has joined the Fair Labor Association. It's a nonprofit labor rights group. And this week, the FLA began an audit of three Foxconn sites. For more on that audit, we're joined now from Shenzhen, China, by the president of the Fair Labor Association, Oret Van Heerden. Mr. Van Heerden, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And first, I'd like you to explain the depth of this audit. Where will you be? How many workers will you be interviewing?
It's a very extensive assessment. We will actually be on three different sites. Each one has over 100,000 workers. So we've taken a representative sample of over 35,000 workers.
Apple CEO Tim Cook said yesterday that 84% of Apple's suppliers are in compliance with the company's labor and human rights standards. One standard is no more than 60 hours of work in a week. I'd like to understand this. If your monitors hear that people are said to be volunteering to work 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, is that a violation even if someone claims it's voluntary overtime that they're working?
It is. China labor law is a little stricter than that, and code limit that most companies have agreed to is 60 hours. So that is certainly a challenge that we need to address.
Are you confident that the workers whom your monitors will be talking to will feel confident to speak their minds and will not be intimidated by the threat of losing their job?
Right. We are obliged to do our interviews on site simply because of the nature of the sample. So what we've done is we've built in as many protections as we can. The questionnaires are anonymous. It's filled out on an iPad, and the data is automatically uploaded to the cloud, so there's no way that the data can be linked back to any worker. But let me just mention that we've been doing this in China for some time now, and we've actually found that workers are very outspoken. It's a seller's market, if you like, and workers change jobs readily because if they hear of better conditions somewhere else, and they know that they can get a job very easily.
What do you say to critics of the Fair Labor Association who say that because it is paid by the employers, its outlook is suspect from the start, that this isn't something, your audit is not equally in the interests of employers and employees?
This was a concern right from the start. So they built into the design of the FLA and its governance structures certain protections. The first one is that the board is made up of equal representatives of companies, universities, and NGOs. And so it's the job, if you like, of the NGO and university reps to make sure that the company reps cannot dominate the discussions in any way. But the second, even more important protection is that we publish our results. And this is really an essential discipline on the entire process, because if we publish results which are, so we say, too rosy or which look like we are whitewashing certain issues, they simply won't be credible.
And I'm just curious, Mr. Van Heerden, since the Fair Labor Association has been at this for a while, can you point to any trend toward greater compliance with labor law in Chinese factories, or is it pretty much the same as it was 10 years ago?
No, they're very, very interesting developments here. The first one is that the Chinese government itself has been driving up the standards. For example, in about the last 18 months, they've adopted a number of major laws which regulate the labor market. So I just had a Chinese government official explaining to us today that they are not interested in the low-wage, low-skill, low-profit margin version of development. They want a high-wage, high-skill, high-margin development path.
Well, Mr. Van Heerden, thank you very much for talking with us today about it.
Thank you.
It's Aurette Van Heerden, who is the president of the Fair Labor Association, which is conducting the audit of Foxconn, the contractor with Apple. He spoke to us from Shenzhen, China.